This is a podcast from BBC Studios. A commercial subsidiary. Of the BBC.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When the dogs are first starting to run, when they're harnessed and they're ready to go, it's chaos. You have all these dogs and they're just leaping and they're like screaming with excitement, and it's so much power and so much noise.
Welcome to the BBC Earth podcast. The podcast that's going to extremes. I'm Emily Knight.
And then as soon as you pull the quick release and the sled starts moving, they go silent. And all you can hear are the whoosh of snow under the runners and, like, sometimes a little jingling from their collar tags and their breath in the cold air. And you're just going through this silent world.
In this episode, we're paying a visit to some of the most remote places on Earth. The places where, in a world dominated by humans, nature still reigns supreme. We're heading out into the wilderness. And our first journey takes us northwards, to Alaska, on the edge of the Arctic. We'll need a sled, lots of warm clothing, and a team of dogs. We're going to run the Iditarod.
The Iditarod, for anyone who doesn't know, is a 1,000-mile dog sled race across Alaska. And it's completely unassisted. Nobody can help you. You do it entirely alone. My name's Blair Braverman, and I'm a writer and a long-distance dog sledder. The race takes usually between 10 to 14 days for beginners going the speed I was planning to go. And you're crossing the state of Alaska. It's enormous. It's an enormous state.
The Iditarod follows a route from Anchorage in South Alaska to Nome on the coast of the Bering Sea. 1,000 miles of mountains, forests, wide open tundra and frozen waterways. It was originally a supply route in the days when the only way to get in and out of central Alaska was by dog.
I mean, mushing goes way back. It's a way that a lot of indigenous people traveled around frozen places. You have these dogs who have this huge instinct to go forward and to pull. They have that instinct in the same way that a retriever has, you know, a drive to get a tennis ball and bring it back to you forever. And so you put them in harness and you hook them to the front of a sled or a cart and they pull you. And when they're trained, they can go up to 100 miles a day.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go!
So when I'm on the starting line, you know, there's all these crowds cheering and the dogs are just like leaping and barking and they're so excited to go. And there's people with signs and there's all this excitement. It's really fun to watch the start of a dog sled race or the finish. You just, there's not a great way to watch the middle. It made for a great start to the race. And then, you know, a couple hours later, you don't see anyone. And that's when you're going to be alone for days or weeks.
Around 50 mushers take part in the Iditarod every year, each with a team of up to 14 dogs. The race works in stages, with the teams stopping at checkpoints to rest and restock the sleds. The rest of the time, you're on your own.
I mean, the biggest thing about the Iditarod was the different kinds of wilderness you pass through because it's so long. You know, I've been in races that were, you know, 200 miles on a river or 200 miles through a forest or 200 miles on tundra. You sort of got all of the above in the Iditarod. It was all of those in one race. We went up and over the Alaska Range, this mountain range. I mean, just up and down it, you know, and then you cross parts of the frozen Bering Sea. You go 200 miles up the Yukon River, dodging these bathtub-sized holes that go down into the river below, which is very scary because there's a current. So if you fall in, you get swept under the ice. I grew up in California, and I was always obsessed with sled dogs. I had this golden retriever named Gilly, and I used to, like, put on rollerblades and tie myself to her, which was neither of us knew what we were doing. But I love dogs, and I loved being outside. And so to me, like, this idea of getting to work with multiple dogs in beautiful places, like, it just seemed, like, too good to be true. People expect to see, like, Hollywood sled dogs, you know. They've seen movies, and they expect them to be Siberians. But the Siberian huskies you see on the street or in dog shows are not really sled dogs. And what most mushers use are Alaskan huskies, which is a nice way of saying a working mutt of the north. They're basically the village dogs from Alaska that were never bred for appearance, but were really hardy and tough, and they're built for speed, not power.
Good dog.
Oh man, they have such personalities. We have this one leader who is kind of a prodigy. I mean, she's amazing. Her name is Peppy. She got us across the sea ice. She got us through vast stretches without any snow. She got us through rivers. I mean, I don't think we would have done it without her guidance.
Good girl, Peppy.
I have this dog named Colbert. He's very large and very, very happy all the time. He was the only dog who had to go on a diet while he was running the Iditarod race. The vets would be like, is this real? Like, how is this dog this fat? I ended up dropping him at the last checkpoint because he got into my sled bag and ate two massive bags of chicken skin and was still very cheery but had terrible diarrhea. The biggest challenge was anticipating the dog's needs. They don't have to worry about food. They don't have to worry about water. They don't have to worry about rest because whenever they start getting hungry, I'm going to be there with food. Whenever they're thirsty, I'm going to be there with water. Whenever they're tired, what do you know? I've planned a rest for that. And so they learn to trust me, and all they have to think about is doing what they love and running forward. You see their shoulders moving and their legs like pistons going up and down, and I'm reading those rhythms all the time. If their ears start flapping a different way, it tells me something. You know, if the way they change their head or the way they hold their chin or the way they hold their tail, like all those little micro movements are telling me things about the dogs. They're telling me if they're starting to get tired, if there's an animal in the woods that I can't see, that's where all my focus is. People always say, like, oh, I couldn't do it, I get too cold. But cold is a skill, it's a practice. You can learn how to be warm. And once you know that, once you have that practice, you can see things you would never see otherwise. And that's the addiction, I think, is getting to be part of this world that so few people get to see. I didn't think I was gonna finish. I didn't really believe it until I saw the finish line. It was before dawn. The dawn sort of came up over the Bering Sea, over the Bear Mountains, as I was getting closer to town, and it was very windy. I was trying to keep from being blown off the pack trail and ending up in this deep snow where we could, you know, really have to dig our way out. And then it was very strange. I mean, we just kept going sort of minute by minute, and then there were, you know, houses, and then we were on the street, and then there's more and more people, and then you get to the finish line, and I just thought I was dreaming. I mean, for days, I thought I was dreaming. I thought I had fallen asleep at a checkpoint and dreamed that I finished and that I hadn't really done it. You know, I think I'd had this idea. I've heard all these stories about Alaska my whole life. And so I've done a lot of mushing in the Midwest. I've done mushing in Canada. I've done mushing in the Scandinavian Arctic. And it was more wilderness. You know, wherever you are, wherever there's wilderness, it's real. Some of it's bigger than others, but it's all just as real.
When we talk about wilderness, we usually mean somewhere untouched by human hands. Places we find hard to get to, like the frozen poles, or hard to survive in, like the parched desert. But there's one environment we find hardest of all, one wilderness so inaccessible that we've explored less than 5% of it, and it covers 70% of our planet. It's the ocean. If you really want to get away from it all, you've got to go deep.
When you go down there, it's almost like ethereal. It's so quiet. All you can hear is the submersible that you're in. And of course it's dark because there's no light past 400 meters. And you're just surrounded by all of these weird and amazing animals that are adapted to live in this incredibly extreme environment. My name is Diva Raymond and I'm a deep sea biologist. I'm currently based at the Natural History Museum in London, but I'm originally from Trinidad and Tobago. There are very few careers that allow you to be amongst the first people on the planet to see something, and that's what we do as deep sea scientists. We are always finding new species, new habitats, new behaviours. So little of it has been explored. I mean, we really cannot answer that incredibly basic question of what lives there for most of our oceans.
Deep sea biologists like Diva find out about the species and habitats of what lie beneath by sending robots or autonomous vehicles to gather information on their behalf. Or, on rare occasions, she gets to go down there herself in a submersible. With one tiny round window per person to look out from, it's like a human-sized washing machine.
You do get a perspective that you don't get from using any other type of equipment. It's small, and you can't stand it's that small. I mean, of course, I think it's totally normal to be nervous before going down to somewhere where no one can come and rescue you if something goes wrong. You start to descend, and all of that worry sorts of goes away because you're glued to the window, this tiny 6-inch sphere window. As you pass through the sort of twilight zone, there's just the most amazing bioluminescence. Like fireworks going off outside the window just constantly for about half an hour of every colour, shape, description. Before you know it, you're on the deep sea floor.
A big part of Diva's work is to understand the threats that the creatures of the deep are facing.
Given that resources on land and in shallow waters are dwindling, we now know that certain areas of the deep sea may be targeted for certain types of exploitation. So we can begin to think about what might be endangered, but there are very few animals in deep sea that we can categorically say are endangered.
One deep sea species that Diva and her team have studied is the scaly-foot deep sea gastropod, also known as the scaly-foot snail, or sea pangolin.
The snail is really remarkable because it has the largest heart-to-body ratio of any animal on the planet. The heart is about 4% of its entire body. For comparison, humans is about just over 1%. Because it lives in this metal-rich environment, it uses a lot of those metals to create these scales that cover its foot. And it literally looks like it's wearing a sheet of armor. It has these bacteria within its body that uses the chemicals coming out of the seafloor where it lives to make its food.
The scaly-foot snail lives in places we've only just discovered and find almost impossible to get to. And yet, that doesn't stop us causing havoc.
We know that one is endangered because they're only found in 4 tiny areas in the Indian Ocean. 3 of those 4 areas are actually found in leases where deep sea mining may occur in the future.
It's the first deep sea species to be added to the Red List, the IUCN's list of endangered animals, as a result of deep sea mining. Now that scientists know they're down there, they can monitor them more effectively.
Mining hasn't happened yet, but we can say that if it does, those animals are of the most vulnerable.
The things you find on the ocean floor aren't all as remarkable as the scaly-foot snail.
Nearly every expedition I've been on, we see remnants of us. Last year, I was with the NOAA ship, Oceanus Explorer, and we were working in the Gulf of Mexico, in places of the Gulf of Mexico that no one had been to yet. And we had identified this target in our sonar, which looked a lot like a shipwreck. It was about 40 feet long, and they had what looked like a debris field around it. And that's like a characteristic thing of a shipwreck. And we had bets going on board, like how old it would be, what it might have been used for. And as we got clearer, we were like, what the heck? And it turns out it was a shipping container that had obviously fallen off of a ship, in the process been ripped open, and that debris field was washing machines, fridges, freezers, like dishwashers, just scattered all over the seafloor. And it was the most surreal experience to be working at over 1.5 kilometers depth in the deep sea, a part of the deep sea that no one had been to yet, and we're driving through household appliances. It was just this very surreal experience. The deep sea is so fundamental to us being here. It is absolutely important for these huge global processes that keep our planet habitable. It sequesters carbon and it absorbs heat, plays a massive role in climate regulation. Without our oceans, we would not be able to live here because our planet would be so hot. It cycles nutrients, it detoxifies our seas, and it inspires us. That's something that people forget. And I think if, you know, the deep sea were to go away, we wouldn't be looking at a very bright future at all.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
You're listening to the BBC Earth podcast, where this week we're wandering, lost and alone, in the wilderness. In wild places that not many people ever get to go to. Places like the Daintree Rainforest on the northeastern coast of Australia.
You board a ferry over the Daintree River, and once you cross that river, you're no longer connected to mains power. Everything's run off generators or solar. There's no police over there. There's no hospital over there. And you feel like you're entering Jurassic Park. They say that if you've got something to hide or you're running from something, you live in the Daintree.
It's the Wild West. It's really strange. There's rumours about a prison breakout that happened in the late 80s, and a lot of the prisoners that broke out made their way over to the Daintree.
But this isn't a story about escaped criminals or outlaws. It's about these two.
Oh, I'm going first. My name is Ed Salto, and I'm a wildlife cameraman.
If anyone knows anything about the Daintree Rainforest, they do.
My name's Dan Hunter, and I'm also a wildlife cameraman.
It may be hard to get to, but that's not the most extraordinary thing about the Daintree. It holds the record for being the oldest forest on Earth.
It's like there hasn't been a change in climate, there hasn't been a change in the geology and geography. It is basically how it was over 120 million years ago. Mm.
I think scientifically it's actually the world's oldest continuous surviving patch of rainforest.
But it also just plays into what we imagine just an ancient old place to be. It's dark and overgrown and sort of mysterious. And there's just things growing on everything. Every tree has vines wrapped around it, and the vines have fungus growing out of it, and there's moss on the other side of the tree. Like, every surface is something is growing on it or living on it.
Among the species that thrive in the Daintree are trees that have been unchanged from the days of the dinosaurs, and plants that evolved long before pollinating insects were a thing.
A lot of the mid-story of the forest is these fan palms, these really thin trunked trees that will completely block out the light if there's a lot of them. And they're all about 20 metres high, and I think they grow, was it 1 metre every 100 years?
Mm-hmm.
So that's 2,000-year-old stand of fan palms.
Stepping inside the undergrowth is like walking back in time. And if you walk back in time, perhaps you shouldn't be surprised when you come face to face with a very ancient predator.
A cassowary is Australia's, I guess, forest version of an ostrich. It's a little bit shorter, a bit heavier, but it's all done up in sort of like its war dance outfit. It's got jet black feathers. On its head, it's got this bizarre cask, like a veil. And then its face is vivid cobalt blue, and then the neck is bright red. And I guess the other defining feature is their feet. They're just enormous. And the inner toe is mostly this large, sharpened...
dagger.
Yes. Claw.
They look like a... a glorified velociraptor, essentially. And if you see one in the forest by yourself, it's hard not to be frightened.
And in case you were still in any doubt about whether or not this enormous, scaly-faced bird is a descendant of the dinosaurs, this is the territorial call of a female cassowary.
Cassowaries are kind of unique because, unlike most birds, the cassowary dads, raise the chicks. So they'll sit on the nest for about 2 months. They have a very strong bond with their chicks, and they raise them and teach them the laws of the jungle.
I set up a hide in the right area and saw Crinkle Cut, the male who we were trying to film. His name was Crinkle Cut because he had a warp in his cask that looked like a chip. But I didn't see the chicks. I just heard, or thought I heard, the chicks. Eventually, Crinkle Cut crossed a little creek in front of me, and then shortly behind him, two little chicks launched themselves into the ankle-deep water and splashed their way across. They're just like little, tiny, little fluffy chicks that squeak all the time. They can get washed away in ankle-deep water. They can get tangled up in the forest. They can fall prey to pigs, snakes, dingoes that would take a chick. Just innumerable ways that a chick in a Daintree could die.
But in saying that, it's also like having the coolest dad in school. So your dad could disembowel a feral pig if he wanted to, or he could kick a dingo to death, and he will. He'll do that for you. So, yeah, you're in good hands if your dad's a cassowary. He'll do anything for those chicks, and it is unlike a relationship I've seen between birds before.
You know, he's an enormous animal. He can jump sort of over a metre high. They can disembowel pigs and things like that, but at the same time, he'll use his beak to gently break open a piece of fruit and peel off little tiny bite-sized pieces for a chick. Anyone who tells you they've never slept in a hide is a liar. Every cameraman's dozed off at some point. I remember this day, it was quite a warm day, and we're both in our hides by a perfect little rainforest creek that's just trickling by. It would have been after lunch, it would have been about 2 o'clock, and I just remember sort of leaning my head back and just thinking, oh man, I could just go to sleep now. But just before I fell asleep, I heard the squeaks of a cassowary chick. And so I snapped back to focus and looked out the front of my hide. And I saw Crinkle Cut and his two chicks on the other side of the creek, right next to Dan's hide. Crinkle Cut had his head basically touching the mesh inches from Dan's head. I just remember sitting there thinking, oh man, Dan is getting one hell of a view. Probably the closest you can get to a wild cassowary. And then Crinkle Cut turned around, wandered across the creek, the chicks followed, they fed for a little bit, then they headed off. The first thing I said was, oh man, how was that with Crinkle Cut coming up right next to your hide? And Dan's like, what are you talking about? I was like, he was right up next to your hide. He's like, I don't know. I was like, you fell asleep, didn't you? He's like, yes. And so Crinkle Cut came about a centimetre from Dan's sleeping head. What he didn't know is that I saw the whole thing.
I think Crinkle Cut was listening to me snore. I think that's why he was putting his head so close. He was fascinated by the sound.
When they walk through an old part of the Daintree rainforest, they certainly feel like it's their forest. And I guess technically it kind of is. They planted it.
There's a tree called the Riparosa, which the cassowary has a symbiotic relationship with. The fruit of the Riparosa has to pass through the gut of the cassowary. So this is an ancient symbiotic relationship. I mean, it must be millions and millions of years old.
When you sit around and start thinking about it, it kind of blows you away. You're surrounded by 2,000-year-old trees that the seeds for those trees would have had to have passed through a cassowary, because that's the only way they can germinate. So really, you're in a forest that was planted by cassowaries.
The hottest place on our planet is the appropriately named Death Valley in California. The snakes, insects and birds that make it their home are well adapted to the heat. Humans, well, we have air conditioning. The world record for the coldest temperature on the planet was minus 89 degrees Celsius at a Russian research station in Antarctica. Even the penguins can't survive temperatures that low. Our next story comes from a place that's neither the hottest nor the coldest on Earth. What makes it extraordinary is that it comes close to being both. Bomochod Alam, an anthropologist at the National University of Mongolia, spoke to us from Ulaanbaatar, the closest city to the Gobi Desert.
If you imagine the map of Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar is central. Further to the south is desert. When you drive for about 100 kilometers, sometimes you don't see a family. And then finally, after like 100 kilometers, you find one family. In the Gobi Desert, we don't have much construction or towns or cities. Most of the people are herders.
Families of the Gobi Desert herd camels and goats.
Livestock is the source of life for those who have a herding way of life. And it's not only in terms of product or as consumable goods, but in terms of everything, spiritually, psychologically, materially. When herders have lots of animal fortune, they also have life fortune. The average household has at least around 50 camels. So camel is the main source of life for herders in the Gobi Desert, both in terms of riding, transportation and food.
Bactrian camels are native to this region and are extremely well adapted to the harsh desert environment. They're large and robust and can go for long periods without water. Their two distinctive humps store fat, which can be converted to water or energy. They can close their nostrils to keep out the sand. Their long lashes protect their eyes, and their tough, wide feet can weather long journeys. In the springtime, as the treacherous winter lows move towards the 40-degree summer highs, mother camels start to give birth after a long 13-month pregnancy. The risks are high. Fluctuating temperatures, high winds, the Gobi Desert is not an easy place to give birth. The mother or the calf may perish, leaving orphaned babies and grieving mothers. Other times, the mother simply rejects their newborn calf.
We can't really be certain on why a camel rejects a calf. I guess the reason can be quite various.
Without their mother's milk, the new calves are in danger. And it's not only the animals. Herding families who rely on camel's milk for food, drink and medicine also suffer when it runs dry. With precious few calves born every year, the stakes are high.
If it goes on for too long, the calf will have not much food and the herders will have to find other ways to feed calves.
But over generations, the herders of the Gobi Desert have developed a unique ritual, a kind of desert magic which helps to bond mothers to their calves. A ritual which saves the lives of newborns desperate for their mother's milk.
So if a mother camel rejects its calf, the family members usually look for some local musicians who can play a horse head fiddle.
Local in the Gobi Desert can mean a family member having to walk for days to find that musician.
And the musician comes and plays the musical instrument for the mother camel.
The ritual can take hours, with the musician changing their tune depending on the camel's reaction.
The camel usually starts weeping, so you can actually see the camel's tears coming out from its eyes. I mean, camel is a large, big animal, and when they weep, the tears can be quite big drops. I mean, compared to our tears, human tears. After crying a bit, the camel stops rejecting its calf, and then the calf starts feeding from the mother. I think it can even make a human being cry too. So it means that Mongolians discovered that animals have some sense or similar sense to music, like human beings have towards music.
It isn't clear why the camels weep. But for those communities isolated in the desert, this mythical tale is very real. And when it works, when a camel mother manages to keep a calf alive, the camel herding families of the Gobi Desert can thrive too.
I can't figure out how Mongolians first discovered this. Like, who can think of playing a musical instrument for animals to help them bond? Somehow Mongolian herders found it out, I don't know when, and they are still practicing it. And the interesting thing is, it works.
You've been listening to the BBC Earth podcast. Stories were produced by me, Emily Knight, and Eliza Lomas. Next week, we'll be asking ourselves questions we don't know the answer to, and investigating some of the natural world's most puzzling mysteries. And if you can't wait that long for a dose of animals, nature, and science from BBC Earth, sign up to our newsletter to get your fix right now at bbcearth.com/newsletter.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.